facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Marvelous Monday to you. So glad you're with me for another week on The Cale Clark Show. And we've got a great one for you today. 1-888-914-9149 is the toll-free line to call. Once again, toll-free. The call's on me. 1-888-914-9149. We also have a Twitter account as well for the show, at Cale Clark Show. Check it out. Also, my personal account. You can follow me there, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. The email account, the address is cale@relevantradio.com. Well, let's get right to it, because we have an amazing guest who is on the line right now. He is a professor of philosophy at Boston College, and according to his official biography on his website, he loves his 5 grandchildren, 4 children, 1 wife, 1 cat, and 1 God. He has also written more than 1 book. In fact, 95 books. 95. I don't know if that's his personal response to Martin Luther's 95 Theses or not, but among those 95 books are his current book, which just came out, called How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss, which was just published by Ignatius Press. Joining me from his home in Massachusetts, Dr. Peter Kraft is my guest. Dr. Kraft, thank you for taking the time, and how are you today?
You're welcome. I hope I'm fine. Ask God. He knows everything.
That is true. That is absolutely true. Well, Dr. Kraft, the first time that I met you was several years ago when you were giving a talk at the University of Toronto on marriage and the family. I don't know if you remember this one, but that talk was actually protested. Picketers were there. They were handing out T-shirts and buttons saying, stop hate language at the University of Toronto. And you were being actively heckled during that talk. And I just thought you were cooler than the other side of the pillow. You didn't break a sweat. You didn't break stride. You just gave your talk, had an open mic session, and people just let you have it. I mean, you were being heckled during that talk. And even during the Q&A session, people were just so full of vitriol, and you just very calmly dressed them down, dissected their ideas. And I remember one guy that was there, he was at the end of the line. He was so angry when he came up. And one of the things that you said to him was, I can see that you're actually a very unhappy person. And for that, I am genuinely sorry. And I literally thought the guy was going to break down and cry on the spot, because you touched something there. It was true. And at the end of it all, is a lot like the incident with Jesus and the woman caught in adultery. Everyone kind of dropped their stones and walked away. The protest was diffused. The air went out of the balloon. And as you were being whisked away to your next presentation, I overheard you say, hey, that was fun. That's when I knew you were a different kind of cat. But I think the subject matter of the talk that you gave that day is really related to your latest book, How to Destroy Western Civilization. And it seems to a lot of people, I think, today that Western civilization maybe already lies in ruins. So, question for you, Dr. Kraft, is it too late to save Western civilization, number one? And secondly, why is Western civilization worth saving in the first place?
Those are two very good questions. And thank you for not being the University of Toronto, where the president assured his students I would never set foot again. That's supposed to be a Catholic school.
That's right.
Number one, is it savable? I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. And since we don't know, we've got to try. Mm-hmm. Is it worth saving? Of course. It was once called Christendom. In the Old Testament, God's chosen people fall many times, spiritually, physically, militarily, and they bounce back. It's a pattern. It's like a roller coaster. We're certainly on a down right now. Mm-hmm. People leave the church every year for everyone that enters.
Right.
In Europe, it's 10 to 1. That's not inevitable. Prophets do not predict the future. They just warn. Mm.
That's very true. And one of the things that you talk about in your book, Dr. Kraft, is that really you start off this way, saying that the only real way to save Western civilization is to have children. Why is this so important?
Well, that's the very first thing, because without children, there's no people, and without people, there's no civilization. Also, the act of having children is an act of faith and hope in the future, and that life in this world is worth living. I hear many people almost never poor people, almost always rich people, say that I wouldn't bring children into this terrible world. And I don't say it, but I can't help thinking you are a liar and a hypocrite. Because you know darn well that this world is the best it's ever been for secular matters. We have healers, we have doctors, we have medicines, we have long life expectancy, we have high standard of living, we have all sorts of fun and games. A middle class person today has more than the richest king had 1,000 years ago. So the only possible meaning you could possibly have in saying this is a terrible world is that it's spiritually terrible. And I agree with you. But that's not what you mean.
Yeah, that's right. That isn't what they mean. And by the way, you're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Dr. Peter Kraft, talking about his new book, How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss. You're right in saying that there's a lot of material wealth. There's a lot of materially, we've never had it better in so many ways. Spiritually, we've never had it worse. And one of the things that is lacking in our world, this kind of touches on spirituality a little bit, is the lack of heroes in our society. And you have a whole chapter about that in your book, The Lack of Heroes in Today's World. And actually, one of the things that you, as a Canadian, my back got up a little bit when you wrote this. If you want to see an advanced case of men turning into sheep, visit Canada. I think Canada can be saved only by massive immigration from the Lower East Side of New York City. Ouch! I can only say to that, Dr. Kraft, I'm very sorry, eh? But one of the things you do talk about, obviously,
you're apologizing for being so apologetical.
There you go. There you go. It'd be un-Canadian not to do that. But why is it that so many people today don't have any heroes in their lives?
Because to have a hero presupposes that some things are heroic. You don't just decide that you're a hero. You become one by practicing some heroic virtue. But if there's no such thing as virtue, if virtue is a fake, if the natural moral law is a fake, if objective morality is a fake, if we invent our moralities as we invent our entertainments, then there can't be a hero by definition.
That's very profound, to be sure. Speaking of heroes, I've heard you write elsewhere and say elsewhere that you mentioned this in the chapter as well, that you're asked by someone who's babysitting your kids for a school project. She asked you who your heroes were, and you mentioned, of course, Jesus, naturally, Socrates, your father, Chopin. Why were these people heroic to you personally? What did each one of them? Obviously, with Christ, it's pretty obvious, but with the others, like Socrates, why is he a hero to you?
Well, Socrates made me a philosopher. He gave me his mind. Jesus gave me eternal life. He gave me his body. And my father gave me 50% of my physical body together with my mother.
Well, hey, those are. Not bad reasons to have these people as your hero, but another hero that you mentioned elsewhere, and I have to ask you about this just to make sure it's the same person. You've also mentioned that one of your heroes is Bill Lee. Would that be Spaceman Bill Lee of Boston Red Sox fame?
Yeah, he's a hero of humor. He's probably the funniest baseball player in the world. He is spacey and he's weird, but he makes you laugh. And that's almost a divine calling. To be a genuine comedian is to make people happy, and saints make people happy. Saints are not always comedians, but, well, maybe they are, because God's a comedian. The funniest thing that ever happened to the devil 2,000 years ago on Calvary. I mean, God must be laughing up his sleeve.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
The most tragic thing that ever happened is also the funniest and most joyful thing that ever happened. We call it Good Friday.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it, to be sure. And no doubt, that was a trick that the Lord played on Satan, and it worked. It's the whole Christus Victor theory, kind of, he thought he had the last laugh, but far from it.
If you remember that movie, The Passion of the Christ, at the moment Christ dies, you hear a groan that seems to be coming from the earth. That's the devil. He tricked me.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And that's such a great film, and it's such, I mean, every Good Friday, it's a lot of people watch that film, and I know that you personally like that film too. You've written about that as well. And in fact, even in this book, you talk about that scene in the movie where Mary comes to Christ. He's fallen down and he's picking up the cross. And she's like, you've gone too far, haven't you? I mean, when is this going to be enough? And you want to fill in the rest,
Why do you have to do all this? And then he says what I call the greatest line in the history of cinema. See, Mother, I make all things new.
Yeah, and that is so true. You also write about how really that movie is mostly about us. And Mel Gibson did talk about, you know, when the film was released, that, you know, especially the flogging scene, which I don't think was over the top, obviously, given the history of Roman floggings, what we know about them. But one of the things he said about that scene is that the audience has to suffer. The audience has to be drawn into that. And he put himself in the movie, obviously, too. He was the person who pounded in. You don't see his face, obviously, but he was the one pounding the nails in, the spikes, Christ to the cross, as a stand-in for you and I, of course. And so, I don't know if you want to elaborate on that a little bit more.
That's not a movie. That's not a spectator sport. That doesn't happen on the screen. That happens in the real world. And he puts you right there. It's almost miraculous.
Yeah, it's absolutely classic. And I'm looking forward to his new film on Resurrection, to be sure. That'll be something else, too. I don't know when that's going to come out. But at any rate, we look forward to it. My guest is Dr. Peter Kraft. We're talking about his new book, How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss, published by Ignatius Press. And by the way, Bill Lee is an ex-Catholic. I don't know if you know that, but you might want to reach out to him. Maybe you can evangelize the spaceman.
I think half of America is an ex-Catholic nowadays.
Yeah, that
largest religious denomination around.
Yeah, that's true. And if only we were all practicing. And again, another thing that you write: if everyone could spend just a few minutes in Eucharistic adoration every day, if every Catholic did that, it would transform society, transform the world, to be sure. And one of the things that you mention in the book too, speaking of society, a very misunderstood term in today's culture is liberalism. And there's a chapter on that as well. Why is the term liberalism so confusing today for people?
Well, first of all, because it changes its meaning in time and even place. Classic European liberal is almost the same as the classic American conservative. It also changes its meaning in time. I used to call myself a liberal. Now I call myself a conservative. I haven't changed my mind on any issue. They just changed the labels. But liberalism wants to maximize liberty, which is fine, which is a very good thing, or freedom. But the classic meaning of freedom is to be free from obstacles to your genuine good, free from evil. What we mean by freedom today is usually simply freedom to do whatever you want, whether it's good or evil, freedom from any obstacle. And that's a very different kind of freedom.
And obviously, your view is, there's no way we can sustain this going forward. So what is the way out here?
Repentance. That's very clear Bible. Sometimes the only way forward is to go back. When you're working out a complicated mathematics problem, let's say, and you know you made a mistake, you can't just go forward hoping to undo the mistake. You got to go back and untie the knot. You got to repent. And if reality is as objective in this world that we touch and see as it is in math, if real people are as objective as numbers, then you can't have a right relationship with real people by continuing to go along the road that's destructive.
Yeah, absolutely. And that way back may be very difficult for us to get on that road, but it certainly has to be done if we're going to save the civilization. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Dr. Peter Kraft, author of the new book, How to Destroy Western Civilization. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back after these really quick messages with more from Dr. Kraft. Stay with me.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Welcome back to the program on this Monday. My guest today is Dr. Peter Kraft, philosophy professor at Boston College and the author of a brand new book called How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss, published by Ignatius Press. And Dr. Crave, before the break, we were talking a little bit about liberty. And another issue in the culture today that's obviously at the forefront of everybody's mind is the issue of sexual liberty. How is religious liberty being attacked today by sexual liberty?
Well, those who want so-called sexual liberty or sexual autonomy are threatened by our beliefs. I think we've crossed a line when the establishment no longer wants us to simply hold back in acting against people's behavior, but wants to forbid certain beliefs. If we believe that there are such things as sexual sins, if we believe that, as every single Christian without exception in the world believed for almost 2,000 years, that sodomy was intrinsically wrong, if we believe that, we threaten them, and that's hate speech. And even if we don't speak it, we can't believe it. There was a Christian couple in England some 10 or 15 years ago who were foster parents, and they had quite a few foster children, some gay, some straight, and there was no problem. And the state came to their door and said, you're Christians. Do you believe in everything in the Bible? And they said, yes. Do you believe in everything that is in the book of Leviticus? Yes. Do you believe then that homosexuality is intrinsically wrong? Yes. Well, then you can't have children. They took the children away from them. Mm. Not from what they did, but for what they thought. Now, that's 1984, where crimes extend to what you think.
Yeah, well, that's a great follow-up question, because maybe the answer is yes. Is Western civilization at the point of 1984, that famous novel by George Orwell, or Brave New World? And if you could briefly describe the importance of these two books for today's culture, for anybody listening today who may not have read those, what do you think about that question?
I don't think we're heading towards 1984 because we don't like violence. We don't like dictatorship. We don't like totalitarianism, thank God. But as Alex de Tocqueville pointed out in his great little book, Democracy in America, which I think is the best thing anybody ever wrote about democracy, there's kind of totalitarianism. There's hard totalitarianism, like the Nazis, and then there's soft totalitarianism, which doesn't use force, but simply pressure, the media, the spirit of the times, what everybody thinks, and that's Brave New World. If you want to see where we're going, if you want a prophecy of the future, read Aldous Huxley's novel, Brave New World. Mm. It was written in 1930, I think, or 1932. Mm-hmm. It sounds as if it was written yesterday.
Yeah. Absolutely, that's the case. And my guest today is Dr. Peter Kraft of Boston College, author of 95 books, including his latest, How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss. And one way to climb out of the cultural abyss, obviously, is to try to seek the common good. And you say that the two most crucial causes of the common good are morality and religion. Now, why is that?
Well, history proves it. Nations and cultures and civilizations that have a respect for morality and believe in a real natural moral law and take it seriously, they last, they survive, they thrive, they're relatively peaceful, they're successful. Cultures which are not. And for most people, the surest foundation for morality is religion. Mm. There may be a few philosophers who, by reason alone, understand a high morality, but religion has been throughout history the foundation of the building of morality. So destroy the foundation, you destroy the building.
It makes sense to me. My guest is Dr. Peter Kraft from Boston College. And by the way, I have to ask you this. Why are you still teaching? I think you are still teaching, because I checked the faculty website of the Boston College website today, and you're still there. I don't know how much you're teaching right now.
I never understood the concept of retirement.
I was actually just going to ask you that, because I met some rabbis once in Jerusalem, and they said that, you know how rabbis think. They say if there's no concept or no word for something in the Hebrew language, then it doesn't really exist, because to them, of course, Hebrew is God's language, and there's no word for retirement in Hebrew. And so they said, really, it doesn't exist. It's not a thing. Obviously, that's your take on it too, I guess.
That's very similar to what a rabbi once told me, that their language has no word for chance.
I like that.
Everything is divine providence.
Hmm. That's good. So obviously you're going to keep working, and that's good news for us because, hey, more books, more exciting things. I know you've got a few others in the works as well. And let me ask you a question about writing, Dr. Kraft. Your output has obviously been prodigious. Talk to me a little bit about your writing process. How did you do it in the midst of a busy teaching, speaking schedule, your family life? And one thing you've said in the past is that the favorite books that you've ever written are ones that you didn't actually write because you didn't write them because your children were small and you're focusing on your family. But obviously you did get down to writing in a big way. How'd you do it? Was there a certain time of day, a certain place you like to write, a certain word count you wanted to get out every day?
Nothing remotely like that. Different people have different methods of doing everything, including praying, including becoming saints, including the really important things. So there's so many different methods for writing. One of my favorite philosophers, Ralph McInerney, had an incredible discipline. He got up like 6 o'clock every morning and wrote for 6 hours straight, and then the rest of the day was free. And that worked. Well, there's nothing like that for me. I write when I get a chance. I write when I go to the bathroom. And I don't know where the books come from. You know, we pretty much well know where things come from, where rain comes from and where trees come from, but we don't know where ideas come from. I suspect that the angels have a much bigger role to play in the life of our thought than we think. And when we get to heaven, we're going to say, oh, thank you for that idea. I didn't realize that was you.
I believe that's true. Ideas, obviously, are so crucial. They're the currency of all these books. And where they come from? Well, very often, it's a heavenly inspiration. And you've had a lot of them, to be sure, with those 95 books that you've written. Dr. Peter Kraft is my guest today on The Cale Clark Show. Well, you're a convert to Catholicism. I'm a revert, and I grew up Catholic, a nominal Catholic, came back. But along the way, I got into ministry in the Christian Reformed tradition. And it was around that time when I discovered your conversion story, when I was on the journey back home to the Catholic Church. And I wanted to ask you, what made you start looking into Catholicism in the first place?
Two words, temptation and history. I was tempted by the beauty and the intelligence and the serious history of the Catholic Church. I read St. John of the Cross when I was a teenager. I didn't understand it, but I said, wow, that's a mountain. Never heard anything like that before. First time I visited a cathedral, I had never been in a church like that before. And I asked my father, who was an elder in the Dutch Reformed Church, Dad, this is a Catholic church, isn't it? Yeah. They're wrong, aren't they? Oh, yeah, they're terribly wrong. I was about 8 years old. I said, then how come their churches are so much more beautiful than ours? He had no answer. So when I went to Calvin College, I learned a lot more about Catholic history and Catholic philosophy and theology, and it seemed to make sense for me. But I thought it was really, really wrong. So I took a course in church history from a very good Calvinist professor. And he explained the difference between the Protestant and the Catholic theory of church history. He said Catholics believe that Jesus planted a church like an acorn, and it gradually grew to become this big oak tree that we see now with all these leaves. But we believe that the church is like Noah's Ark, and in the Middle Ages it accumulated so many external barnacles that it was in danger of sinking. So a couple of soldiers, sailors like Luther and Calvin went overboard and scraped off the barnacles. So it's really the Catholics that are the new kids on the block. We're the old guys. So I remember asking the professor a question. I said, Professor, does that mean if my Catholic friend and I both took a time machine and went back to the first century and worshiped side by side with the early Christians, that I as a Protestant would be much more at home than he as a Catholic? And he said, that's exactly what I mean. So I said to myself, oh, good. I'll prove to myself that I'm in the right church by reading the earliest Christian writings and finding out how Protestant they were. Well, you know the rest of the story.
Yeah, the early church fathers, the most dangerous men in Christianity, as one writer called them, because they're so obviously Catholic. And I think St. Augustine said something to that effect, where if you were go back to the Church of the Apostles, you would only recognize the church as being Catholic. And obviously, you came to that conclusion as well. And
doctrine that blew me away was the Eucharist. Uh-huh. Nobody denied the real presence. It was expressed in different formulas, but nobody thought that it was simply a holy symbol. They worshipped it. And I said to myself, wait a minute, for 1,500 years, all the Christians of the world worshipped what I believe is only bread and wine, confusing it with Almighty God. How could the Holy Spirit have been asleep for 1,500 years? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's a great point. The historical interpretation of the Eucharist is no doubt on the side of the Catholics, and I guess you could say also the Orthodox as well. My guest today is Dr. Peter Kraft, talking about his new book, How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss. And obviously you're a professor of philosophy. What made you want to enter into that as a discipline?
Well, I was an English major in college, and I kept asking philosophical questions about the literature I was reading. And my first philosophy professor was very eccentric. He was probably certifiably insane, so he turned me off from philosophy. And the department chairman said, give it another chance. Try my course instead. And I did, and he was wonderful. He was like Socrates.
So
I think we choose our professions by example. We see somebody that we want to be like, so that's what we go for.
That's true. You know, that's a great point, and I can say that's true in my case too. I've had certain professors that just kind of moved me and inspired me, and obviously that was the case for you as well. And I'm sure that you've inspired many of your students throughout the decades. And speaking about philosophy, you've described philosophy as beginning in wonder. Can you explain what you mean by that, and how is that relevant to our modern culture of skepticism and cynicism?
Well, the three great original philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, all say that philosophy begins in wonder. And there's a wonder that's just emotional wonder, surprise. And that leads to a deeper wonder, questioning, wondering curiously. And that leads to a still deeper wonder, namely admiration. Isn't it amazing? These simple things we take for granted. The more you look into them, the more wonderful they are. So I think all three kinds of wonder are parts of philosophy. But it ends really in a child's wonder. When you get older, you become more like a child. St. John the Evangelist, for instance, when you read his writings, you say, wow, I understand now why he's such a saint. He's so simple-minded. And that's
right.
Not childish. That's childlike. Very different.
Yeah, absolutely. The son of thunder, you know, he becomes the apostle of love and starts, you know, very basic, but very deep truths, to be sure. And, in terms of this wonder, you know, there's the wonders of creation as well. And we talked a little bit about baseball earlier, mentioned Bill Spaceman Lee from your beloved Boston Red Sox. And by the way, I have to ask you, how cathartic was it for you when they finally got over the hump and won the World Series in 2004?
Oh, I had an identity crisis. It's like a Jew becoming secularized. You lose your identity. You become assimilated to the culture. You're normal now. I felt so superior in being inferior. You know, for 86 years, God hated us, and we didn't deserve it. So one of the first questions I'm going to ask God in heaven is, why were you a Yankee fan for 86 years?
My guest is Dr. Peter Kraft, author of the new book, How to Destroy Western Civilization. Well, who knows, with the trading of Mookie Betts to the Dodgers before last season, maybe that's another curse of the Bambino coming up. Who knows? You might get some more chances to grieve in the future.
It's wonderfully unpredictable.
That is for sure. Well, another sport that's important to you is surfing, and you've written a lot about the connections between surfing and spirituality. For those who might be scratching their heads about that one, can you maybe wax eloquently, if you'll pardon my really tortured pun there, surfboard wax? Never mind. But anyways, if you could just talk about that for a moment, that'd be great.
Well, I hope people might ask me what I hope to do in heaven, and my spontaneous answer is I hope to surf on God as I now surf on a wave, because a wave is an amazing thing. It's dynamic and static at the same time, and it's incredibly powerful. And if you go with it, it helps you. And if you go against it, it wipes you out.
It sure does. And there's a lot of connections there between surfing and spirituality, and you've written a lot about that. And you mentioned heaven just briefly well.
There's a book that helps you to understand that connection even. No, it doesn't talk about surfing. It's a spiritual classic, Abandonment to Divine Providence by De Caussade. God's providence is like the wind. It raises the waves of your life, and everything comes from him. So if you go with the wave, you'll succeed. And if not, you won't. And that's the secret of joy. And that's not a kind of naive fideism. That's very rational, too, because if there's a God at all, he's got to be all good, so he wills only our good. And he's got to be all powerful, so he can do whatever he wills. And he's got to be all wise, so he knows it's really for our good. So it's the most logical belief in the world to believe what looks like the hardest thing in the world to believe, Romans 8:28, all things work together for good. Every wave is a wave from God.
Yeah, and that takes faith, to be sure. Absolutely, that's well put. I never thought about Abandonment to Divine Providence as a surfing book, but you made a great case for it there. And speaking of books, and you mentioned just a moment ago, you mentioned heaven very briefly. At that time, I met you at the University of Toronto after giving your talk. I just picked up this book, and I asked you to sign it for me, and it was your book, Heaven, the Heart's Deepest Longing. And you said to me, this is my favorite book that I've ever written. I'm not sure that's still the case. You've written a few more since then, but why was that book so special and important to you personally?
Because it comes from the heart. Most books come from the head, or maybe they titillate the emotions. But I tried to ask myself the honest question, what do I most deeply want? Heaven, but what does that mean? I naturally think about objective things. I'm like a little kid. What's that? What's that? What's that? And this time I tried to turn inward and ask my own heart, what do you want? This is the great thing about Augustine's Confessions. That's what he does there. He discovers not just God, but also the search for God, the restless heart. So to know yourself and to know God always go together. And the lack of them always go together also.
Do you think that we talk enough about heaven in the church today, Dr. Kraft?
No. That's why we have so little hope. We're just trying to endure. But what we have to look forward to is so incredible that, St. Teresa, who suffered very much, said that the life on earth that was most horribly full of suffering, looked at from the viewpoint of heaven, will turn out to be no more serious than one night in an inconvenient hotel.
That's right. A bad night in a bad hotel, yeah. That's a famous quote. And that's absolutely true. And the other day we were celebrating Pope Emeritus Benedict's birthday, his 94th birthday, and I read a little on the show, I read a little excerpt from a homily he preached on his birthday back in 2012. And he talked about that. He said, no matter how rough life is, in essence, you know, in the light of eternity, every life is worth living. To have the opportunity to spend eternity in heaven with our Lord, any suffering would be forgotten the moment that you entered the heavenly shore, of course. And it is something I think we need to preach and teach about a little bit more. We're fond of mentioning sometimes the visions of hell, for example, that St. Faustina experienced, or the children of Fatima, but not a lot of talk about heaven. I think we need to correct that. So thank you for writing that book. I really do.
It makes a difference to this life as well as the next. Imagine somebody walking to London. They've got to put one foot in front of the other, no matter what they're going for, but look at the contrast between somebody who's going there to be executed, to have his head chopped off, and somebody who's going there to be crowned king. They both have the same life. They've gone the same road, but one has hope and the other does not. That's the difference between believing in heaven and not believing in it.
Yeah, and that makes all the difference, not only for this life, but for eternity as well. My guest is Dr. Peter Kraft, author of the new book, How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss. Dr. Kraft, we've got a gentleman on the line who wants to ask you about Socrates and Jesus. Would you like to talk to this person?
Certainly.
Okay, great. Let's bring up Edmund, who's calling from Modesto, California. Edmund, you're live with Dr. Kraft, and what's your question?
Dr. Kraft, how you doing?
Okay, I hope.
Good, good. I read a lot of your books. I read Back to Virtue, Jesus Shock, The Philosophies of Jesus, You Can Understand the Bible. And actually, one of your books, I read it in Arabic. It's called Three Philosophies of Life. Do you know what's translated in Arabic?
Oh, I did not know my books were translated into Arabic. How wonderful.
Yeah, but I read it in Arabic language. Anyways, my question is, because I read Socrates Meets Jesus as well. If Socrates were alive in Jesus' time, would he believe Jesus as the Son of God?
Hmm. Eventually, yes. At first, he would be very shocked. I think what would convert him is Paul's sermon, not to the Athenians, but to the Corinthians. In Athens, he preached to their own philosophy and their own poets, and he got only a few converts. And in Corinth, he said, I'm going to preach Jesus Christ and him crucified. That's all. It's all or nothing. There it is. And Socrates loves to focus on the main thing and not to get involved in distractions. So once he focused on Jesus, once he read the Gospels, I think he would say, wow, that's 10 times farther than I'm ever going myself. Mm-hmm. But he would first be shocked, like the Corinthians were. And Paul says, not many wise are called. Some, but not many.
Mm, that's a great point. Well, thank you very much for that call.
The wise are usually proud. The super intelligent know they're super intelligent, and that makes them sub-intelligent. If you're proud, you're stupid.
Yeah,
Socrates
absolutely.
Is at least humble.
Mm, yeah, and you have to
probably
have that childlike.
The quoted idea of Socrates is that that if you're truly wise, you know you're a fool. And if you're a fool, you think you're wise. That's pretty
wow.
close to what Jesus said. You know, the sinners think they're saints, and saints know they're sinners.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And Dr. Kraft, I have to thank you for your time today. And we've gotten a lot wiser, hopefully, from reading your books and from our time spent with you today on this program. Thank you very much for taking this time out of your busy schedule. Congratulations on the new book. And may it have a wide readership. I really do hope that people pick up this book and read. Once again, the book is How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss. The publisher is Ignatius Press, the author, Dr. Peter Kraft. Dr. Kraft, thank you so much for taking the time on this Monday evening.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me, and God bless you and your work.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That was Dr. Peter Kraft, philosophy professor from Boston College, who's taught there for many years and written many books, 95 books to be exact, and counting. He's got some more on the way, but his new book is called How to Destroy Western Civilization, and it's a great read. I hope you pick it up. And if you want to react to that, you can call in 1-888-914-9149. It's a toll-free line to call. If you have any thoughts on that interview, if you've read the book or any of his other books and you want to talk about that, you can drop me a call, 1-888-914-9149. We'll be right back on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Oh, sorry. I had to do that. Hey, Lucas is trying to get us pumped up on this Monday, playing some happy tunes, getting us going. Well, that was a fascinating interview that we just had with Dr. Peter Kraft, who, of course, has written the new book. I've mentioned this about 1,000 times already, so you're probably sick of me saying this. How to Destroy Western Civilization and Other Ideas from the Cultural Abyss, published by Ignatius Press. Lots of good food for thought there, especially the stuff on heaven, surfing and spirituality, you know, linking that with abandonment to divine providence. Wow, lots to chew on there, to be sure. So really want to thank Dr. Kraft for taking the time to chat with us today here on Relevant Radio. And if you did miss that interview, you can, of course, download the podcast. It should be up at about an hour after the show ends. You can check that out on your podcast provider of choice on relevantradio.com. You can stream it or through the Relevant Radio app. And speaking of declines of civilization, how it's kind of gone down the tubes, this is something that we've talked about a lot on the show, is we need to get into a better balance between work, life, all of that stuff. And we've talked about the need for proper rest and how that can actually paradoxically help us work better. Came across this story that went viral on the New York Times about a British man who had a heart attack, and he was deep into this workaholism culture, and this changed his life. And his name is Jonathan Frostick, and he was a manager at an investment bank, HSBC, in London. And he had a heart attack, very serious, recovered, was still in the hospital, though, when he wrote a LinkedIn post. And LinkedIn is kind of like the Facebook for business users, if you're not familiar with it. And he vowed to step away from work, spend more time on the things that mattered, spend more time with his family, and really start asking some tough questions about life. This really resonated with people. And Maria Kramer wrote this piece last week in the New York Times about this. And basically what happened to this guy, Jonathan Frostick, was that he was at his computer. It was a Sunday afternoon, and he was already starting work on the next week's projects. He was preparing for what was going to happen and meetings he was going to have. And then all of a sudden, he has a heart attack. His chest tightens up. His ears pop. I've never had a heart attack before yet, but I'm not like those Chicago Bears guys, you know. Bill Swirsky, super fans, you know, they kept having heart attacks on Saturday Night Live. How many is that for you? Well, that's a baker's dozen for me. Anyways, I haven't had one, but, Lord willing, we'll see what happens. But he had a heart attack, and his first thought, Jonathan Frostick, as his heart attack started to set in, was how this was going to disrupt his work week. He was thinking, I've got to meet with my manager tomorrow, and this is not convenient at all. That's a problem.
Did you notice he was at his computer on a Sunday afternoon preparing for the work week?
I know. That's part of the problem right there.
It's like there's no rest on Sunday. I mean, yes, we all do it. You know, we've got our phones. We're, you know, constantly connected. It is mm-hmm. It's so hard. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting.
That's one of the first things that jumped out to me as well. And obviously for some people, they can't help it. But as he was convalescing at his hospital bed, he started to really take stock of his life. And this was his post that he put on LinkedIn. He put a photo of himself in his hospital bed in his post. And then he also had these new vows that he made for his life going forward. Number one, I'm not spending all day on Zoom anymore. Number two, I'm restructuring my approach to work. He also said he was no longer going to put up with workplace drama because life is too short. Amen to that. And then the last thing, I want to spend more time with my family. Well, since this happened to him, and since he posted this, that has been liked over 200,000 times. It's received more than 10,000 comments. And a lot of these commenters are talking about their own brushes with death and how that made them step back and look at life in a different way. And so this really resonates because obviously there's been probably more work-related stress during the pandemic, not only with people actually losing their jobs, but people who are still working, they tend to be working even more, even though they're working from home. They're working really long days. And those who have been lucky enough to keep their jobs, as the article says, they've been questioning their purpose in life. They're spending all these hours on Zoom. They're answering emails late into the evenings. And so they're starting to think about, is this healthy? Is this not? I think it's pretty clear that it's not. And one of the, in this New York Times article, there was actually a Canadian who commented on this, a management consultant from Alberta, Canada, who said, I know countless people in the last few years who have suffered life-threatening illnesses simply because there is no downtime. They're always on call. It's detrimental to our health, but we're built on the existence that we always have to keep pushing. People, go ahead, Karen, go ahead.
No, I mean, I'm totally, how many people out there can relate to that right now? If you can relate to that, this is hitting, you know, so many boxes, right? It's just hitting. Mm-hmm. It's just hitting. Do we want to hear from folks? I mean, this is, it's just a...
Yeah, if this is resonating with you.
The pandemic on top of a pandemic, you know?
Yeah, no doubt. And I think one of the things the article mentions, too, there are lots of reasons why people become addicted to their work. One of them is that there are social rewards that come mm-hmm. with a job. Praise from colleagues, connections with supervisors. That can become addictive.
Right.
That can, you know, getting those pats on the back, attaboy. And people become very protective of the identity that their job creates for them. And they almost feel like they don't know who they are outside of work. And this is actually one of the things that Jonathan Frostick said, the guy who made this viral post. He'd been working 12-hour days, working from home. He missed his colleagues. He felt very isolated working from home. And it seems like a lot of his friends were work mates, if you will. And he probably didn't have much time for any other kinds of friends. But later on, after this post went viral, he wrote another one that indicated that he was moving to answer even deeper questions, such as this. He said, quote, "Who am I? Who am I? It's like a riddle my mind cannot solve. I have no idea who I am anymore. This is going to take some time. Can you answer who you are?" End of quote. I thought, wow, that's pretty deep.
It's getting real. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Dr. Peter Kraft was on the show earlier. He's a philosophy professor. Well, that's a pretty philosophical question. Who am I? And obviously our answer has to be rooted in Christ, not in what I do, but in who I am as a child of God. It's very much like Batman. You know, it's not what I do. You know, no, he said, it's what I do. I'm screwing that up. what did Batman say? He said, in Batman Begins, he said, it's not who I am underneath. Yeah, it's what I do that defines me. I don't know if that's necessarily right, because are
know.
You?
Maybe it's wrong again, Batman. I don't know. Are you a human? Comic strip.
are you? But it's got a philosophy too, right?
There's
a philosophy of Batman. I don't know if it's the right philosophy, but we need the philosophy of Jesus. That was another book by Dr. Peter Kraft, The Philosophy of Jesus. But are we human doings? Are we defining ourselves by what we do, or by who we are as children of God, and kind of working from there? Our value is based on the fact that we've been redeemed by Christ. He's created us out of pure love. It's a pure gift. And we have eternal value. One soul, one person is worth more than the entire created universe. Mm. So,
human doings or human beings?
Yeah.
Human beings.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important question to answer, to be sure. And we're going to go to the phones right now. Lee is calling from Arkansas. Lee, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hey, I just wanted to say, you know, as sad as it is, a lot of these people, they work like they do, putting in the excessive hours that they do. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I know, because my job's one of these kind of jobs. And I know for a fact, if I didn't work like this, I mean, I'm 56 years old. If I didn't work like this, they would replace me in a heartbeat with somebody half my age who would be more than happy to put in those kind of hours.
Yeah, what line of work are you in, Lee?
By work contract, I really can't say, but let's just say I work in a lab.
Okay.
I'm a laboratory technician.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a great point.
A lot of people feel like they can't stop, because they'll be replaced so easily. There's so many people out there, they're looking for work, and a lot of people feel that if they don't work these crazy hours. So what's the solution there? What is the solution there? If you want to live a more balanced life, have more time for your faith, your family, but you feel like you really can't. That's a great dilemma, to be sure. Yeah, and thanks for calling in, Lee. I really do appreciate that. I really do.
Hey, no problem. Hey, I love your show. I listen every day.
Oh, thank you very much, Lee. I really do appreciate that, man. Thanks for saying that. Lee calling from Arkansas. And call back anytime, Lee. I really appreciate you. Yeah, and you know, it's we all need encouragement. So thanks for saying that, Lee. Mark Twain once said that he could go a whole month on one word of encouragement. I could use about three a day. So I do appreciate that, Lee. And
True. It goes so far. I think too, you know, when work is fun, you're drawn to it, and it doesn't necessarily, let's say do something you love, and you'll never work a day in your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's something to that as well. But also, I think to the point that Lee was making, if you're ready to leave your job, it can't have to matter to you that you're being replaced by somebody half your age who'll work twice as hard. You know, it's just like maybe time to pass the baton kind of thing. But still, we're made for work. So where do you work next? You know, I mean, you're always working.
Yeah.
This is what we do. Yeah.
And I think so much of what we have to do is think about our motivation. Why are we doing it?
Right.
And obviously, sometimes we do have to do it to put food on the table, to provide for our families, to be sure.
Right.
And, you know, and even if you do realize, and maybe, you know, this is somewhat what Lee's point was, that, and Denzel Washington, the actor, posted this the other day on Twitter. We were talking about this, Karen, you and I,
yeah.
That Denzel Washington said, don't forget that, you know, the second that you leave your job, you're going to be replaced and, in a sense, forgotten about. But your family, they will never forget you. So don't forget what's really important in life.
Yeah.
And that's a great point. And sometimes we feel like we can't really pull back for those reasons like Lee was saying. Yeah, but I do think we do need to focus on why, who we're working for. We're ultimately trying to glorify God in our work and in everything we do in our lives. And that can make a big difference, especially when we don't feel appreciated by others at a human level, that we know we're looking really for the applause of one. And so yeah, there's a lot to be mined there, but unfortunately, we've run out of time for tonight. But we can talk about that any other time. If you want to call back later this week and talk about what Dr. Peter Kreeft was saying earlier, you can call in tomorrow, later this week. We can talk about what Lee said. We have run out of time for today, but do check the podcast later and do follow the show on Twitter at Cale Clark Show. You can follow me too at Cale Clark, and you can ask your question there. I really want to thank Lucas Holt for producing. I want to thank Karen Moran for the great conversation just now. Patrick Kalog worked the phones. Dr. Peter Kreeft was my guest earlier today. I want to thank him for his time as well. Timmy's up next. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.